Over the last few months, it's been a treat to get to know Coco Guzman, a Spanish-Canadian queer artist based in Toronto. Guzman draws, documents, and gathers stories that are public and intimate. They created Missing Democracy, modeled after pet posters posted on utility poles and community bulletin boards, where a grumpy cat stands in for democracy.
And in the bottom of the poster, there's like the description of this cat named Democracy. And it says, "Missing from our city since last elections. She's old and grumpy because of too many upsetting and or fake news."
We speak with Guzman about their approach to working on and in public spaces, especially to deal with memory as monumental and subtle, purposeful ways.
I think what is interesting is to figure out, if you're not an artist and if you're not an activist, how can you leave traces of yourself in the public space, right? In a way that is not being co-opted.
Guzman's Missing Democracy is part of the Highline Joint Art Network's New Monuments for New Cities project. Over the last 6 months, Monument Lab has been research residents of New Monuments for New Cities. And we're speaking with artists from each of the five partner cities, New York, Chicago, Austin, Houston, and Toronto, about monuments, memory, and public space. I'm your host, Paul Farber, and this is Monument Lab. Welcome to Monument Lab, a public art and history podcast. Each episode, we explore stories and critical conversations around the past, present, and future of monuments. We speak to people on the front lines, building the next generation of public spaces through stories of social justice and equity. Here are the monumental people, places, and ideas of our time. Coco Guzman, welcome to the Monument Lab podcast.
Thank you so much, Paul, for inviting me today.
It's great to be in conversation again with you. I want to start with your monument proposal, the poster, Missing Democracy. Could you read from it and describe it in your own words?
Yes, absolutely. So my poster, Missing Democracy, looks like a missing pet poster. So you can imagine it's like a white page with a picture of a very grumpy cat in the center. And then under the cat, on the top, it says Missing Democracy. Last seen was she ever. Reward to have democracy. Contact your friends. And from the cat's grumpy face, there is another like a bubble speech that says, "Find me." And in the bottom of the poster, there's like the description of this cat named Democracy. And it says, "Missing from our city since last elections. She's old and grumpy because of too many upsetting and or fake news. She hates neoliberalism, patriarchy, fascism, and showers. Once she is scratch and eye out of a white supremacist, so racist, stay away. She loves chicken wings, public healthcare, free education, affordable housing, and naps. She responds to, the end of capitalism is coming." And at the bottom, there's like all these little like pieces of paper that people can take out saying, "Find democracy." So that's the poster with a little, there's also a little drawing on the side that it's like the landscape, maybe like of Toronto. So this is a poster I made. I'm coming from Toronto for this exhibition. So I wanted also Toronto to be part of the poster, but it's a very simple, like stick people kind of drawing.
And you were asked as a part of this project, as a part of New Monuments for New Cities, to come up with a monument proposal. How did you go to the missing cat poster as your format?
Yeah, it sounds like there's such a gap, right, between what we consider to be a monument, which is like this thing that is very permanent and usually made of concrete and sculptures and statues, and then this missing pet poster. For me, I was looking at the ways that people leave the traces of their intimate life or their, like, their house life onto the street. I think because I have a pet, I'm always like looking for this missing pet poster, right? And trying to keep an eye out for the missing cat or the missing dog. And I find these posters very interesting because other than like getting to see the picture of the cat, like you get to know a lot about this household, right? Because of the name of the cat, because of the like, the things they like, because the words they use, the emotions they put in the creation of this poster, where the poster is distributed, etc. So, and it also works like as a kind of like memory, because then like this cat may be hopefully be found, and but the poster is, most posters remain. So I'm very interested in people's interventions in the public space. And in a city like Toronto, there are not many ways that actual people can intervene in a way that is like anonymous, in a way that is like just because of their own desire to call for help in this case. So I thought the missing pet poster is actually a way that we continue to leave traces of who we are and our lives in the public space. And I really like also this idea that in the cities that like Toronto, and I imagine like many of the other cities that were invited to participate in this exhibition, I think the erasure of public space also brings the erasure of community building and also community support. So for me, the missing pet poster is also a way that you actually are asking your neighbors, that sadly many of the cities are people who you don't know, you're asking them for help, right? You're asking strangers for help. And I think that's something that is very powerful, actually. And I wanted to bring that into the poster.
You mentioned this idea that it's challenging to intervene into public space, and you've drawn up on your poster this landscape of Toronto that includes the CN Tower and a series of other buildings that look like condominiums or business towers. And, you know, in front of it, there's a figure that says, "Where is democracy?" And then you've pointed to all the buildings and say, "Not here, not here, not here." How does one intervene into public space? And how is it possible to leave traces or at least leave questions?
I mean, I think the intervention can happen in different ways. I think the missing pet poster, for example, is one that is very accessible. And it's also done by people who may not identify as artists or activists, right? And I think that's also an important distinction to have, because I think as a visual artist, when I work a lot with the space, I'm sometimes invited and commissioned and paid to intervene the space, even the public space, right? As an activist, I am not invited, but I will probably do it because the cause or the message I will convey, I believe it is worth to take the public space. And there's an acknowledgement, right, of that activist intervention. I think what is interesting is to figure out, if you're not an artist and if you're not an activist, how can you leave traces of yourself in the public space, right? In a way that is not being co-opted. For example, like by co-option, it could be also good co-options, like, okay, there's like public festivals, right? So I think when we are crossing a street and we are inviting people to come over and dance, these are very important elements, but they're still very much domesticated, right, by the institution. So how can we do otherwise? I think it's like, as like you, Paul, and like a Monument Lab, like I think it's important to figure out how do regular people, while they're not wearing the hat of activist or artist, how can people take that space? For me, I like it very much. I think Toronto is a great city to see how people actually bend the rules sometimes, right? Even if it's just to, like, you know, paint something on the facade of the house that is strange, and paint the house in a strange color, or create this, like, leave, like, little maybe papers all around, like a fence, you know. And I'm trying to think of ways, like, you can see that people are kind of like trying to become a, like a weed, right? Like trying to break those rules. But I actually don't have any, like, I don't have any idea of how that can be done, because we are facing a very strong system that is, it's not only privatization of the public space, but it's also like how the public space has to be hygienic in a way, right? And that is also coming from the fact that this same discourse is breaking down community cohesion. So I actually don't know how we can intervene in the public space.
You've talked about, with your Missing Democracy poster, the idea of the neighbor and the role of the neighbor. And I think in just the examples you brought up about using your house facade or a fence, you're talking about the boundary of public and private space, or maybe public and domestic space. But I guess that question of what does it mean to be a neighbor to a space that's common? How do people operate both as kind of individuals or, you know, private residents on one hand, but balance sharing and holding their own space for themselves as well?
Well, I think, I don't know if you know this, but I'm quite fascinated by washrooms. Like, I do a lot of work on washrooms, and I think it's because they, like, it's not the kind of public space that you would think about, right? Like, I don't know, maybe I have a tendency to think of public space as a park, right? As a square, as something outdoor. But I actually think the washroom, and public washrooms or washrooms that even they are in, like, business, they are this kind of space that is the most public of the private space and the most private of the public space, in a way. And I'm very interested in understanding this, the role of washrooms and the intervention in the washroom from a queer perspective. You know, and what is that space? What does that space has meant in the history of the community? But also, what does this space means in the way that we transfer knowledge, right? Like, with either because people write on it, even if it's just like their phone number, this is a very important piece of information, right? But there's also like sometimes like, warnings, you know, like, oh, if you see that someone is giving you their drink, don't drink it. If you're having like suicidal thoughts, call this number. Like all these other things that I think they're very important, very, very important. And in a way, for me, the washrooms, what it's fascinating about that, this kind of like neighborhood idea of community, but it's this invisible sometimes community, sometimes it's very visible. So yeah, I guess like that brings me to the question of like the public space that we're talking about, and how those spaces have been used and considered to be used to create this community.
I think it's really important that you bring up washrooms, of course, for all of the kind of queer legacies that you bring up. But also, I in a related way, when I'm thinking about the viability or, you know, so-called success of a public space, one of the first questions I ask, no matter what the programming is or what have you, is, are there public bathrooms? Well, and thinking about public bathrooms, public infrastructure, as important as the site or the spectacle?
Yeah, I think that the question of public washroom is super important. Not only because, I think because it also brings a question of, I don't know how to say it otherwise than being like of humanity, you know, because having public washrooms also mean that, you know, you can bring, you can be there with children. You also acknowledge that people have needs. You can be there for a long time. You also like give a space for people to maybe be on their own, to wash themselves, right? There's also this, all these other things that I think are very important in the context of like public space. And if we think also, I don't know, in Philadelphia, but in Toronto, like one of the things that we do, right, in the evening to close a park that doesn't have a fence is to close the washrooms, or in the winter, right? So what does that mean in terms of accessibility to the public space?
That happens here too. You know, so we've asked this question in our residency with the Highline Network: who controls the fate of public space? And from our conversation, you know, my mind is going in a number of ways, but I want to ask that question to you in your context, whether that is Toronto or other spaces that you think of as home. Who controls the fate of public space, or where does your mind go when we ask that question?
Well, I think it's a complex question. I'm trying to think also of like the different spaces I have inhabited, and how public space is so different, right? Like I'm from southern Spain, but I live in Toronto, and I've lived in France, and I've lived in different places. And I think in my experience, obviously there is a dominant discourse of neoliberalism, and I think a policing discourse in general that is controlling, but it's controlling what? And I think for me, urban planning, it's a key element in how we construct public space. I think in my experience, the cities in North America have been built to not have public space. So it is actually very difficult to then promote it, because the roots of a city like Toronto, the construction, the way it has been planned, the way it has been designed, it creates very artificial public spaces, or it creates public spaces that keep being controlled by, I think, you know, the neoliberal powers in place.
Can you give an example in Toronto, whether it's the process behind the creation of public space or just the kind of intent that you speak about more broadly?
Well, for example, I'm thinking of Dundas Square, which is a central square in Toronto. This, for people who have never been to Toronto, like it would look a little bit like Times Square in New York, but much smaller, right? But it is this square that is downtown, surrounded by like very high buildings built all in like metal and glass. And you're completely surrounded by these screens that are very much about like advertising. Right? So it is a public space that invites you to go shopping, for example. There's nothing else you can do there. You can just sit in one of the three benches. Or, for example, talking about benches, like yesterday I was at my studio and there was like a gas leak or something happened. So the firefighters came and I had to leave the building, and I was okay, I'm going to go eat at the park. But in the whole park, there was only one bench. Right? So if you have a public space that is a park with grass and trees, and you only have one bench, so you're clearly very much controlling that people are not going to stop by, right? And they're not going to just be sitting there for a long time. There's actually not public washroom in that park either. So those are forms that limit the time or limit the activities that people can do in those spaces.
You know, when you bring up advertising as part of what encroaches upon public space, or is perhaps like part of the expectation now of having viable public spaces, for you, what is the relationship between the advertisement and the cat poster? because they both occupy space, of course, in different scale and a different way. But I'm curious to just hear you talk about their relationship or their mm-hmm. tension.
That's a very interesting question. I mean, one obviously the obvious difference is that the cat post doesn't sell anything, but I think the space they occupy is also very different. If I'm thinking like either my missing democracy poster or the missing pet poster, I see more the missing pet poster as kind of like a very viral action done by an individual whose interest is just to look for this animal they love, right? There's nothing, there's no relationship with money, for example. There's no relationship with acquisition of something. There's no big corporation. It's someone who made these photocopies, right? So that has that aspect that is very interesting. And yes, they're both occupying the space, but the space they occupy, it is not the same. So for me, like how we use space is very important in relationship to the bodies of the viewers too. So if you think an advertising, like advertisement is like usually quite large. It feels bigger than your body, right? It is usually higher than your body. The colors are very bright, so it stands out. But very interesting that relationship with the body, because advertising is always bigger than you. You know, what I think the missing pet poster, even like for this particular exhibition, the poster was larger than the usual letter size poster. There's still like a one-to-one relationship that is set to the height of your eyes. And it is set like in a format that it still relates to your body and to your own experience of what a sheet of paper is, right? So I think that, like, I know that's not exactly, maybe this is not about the content, it's really about the format and how, like, the effect on the body of the viewer, how these two things are very different.
I love that connection that you make around scale, that even though your poster is presented at a bigger size than the average missing pet poster, it's that notion of eye-to-eye contact. Mm-hmm. And it reminds me of a line that I've jotted down from your artist statement that really stands out to me, which has to do with your interest in what is not revealed to the eye, but lives within our everyday reality as embodied memories or hidden whispers, as you've written.
Yeah.
Could you just share a little bit more about this idea and how that lives in your work, both in the poster and more broadly?
Yeah, well, I mean, for example, I think I feel that we are surrounded by so many stories, right? And in my personal life, I've surrounded by so many things, so many stories, so many secrets, right? So many things that we don't say, but they're still there. They're still latent and we can feel them in our bodies, right? I'm very interested in this question of like, you know, the queer memory that is inhabits our body. It inhabits our ways of either body language or our feelings of safety, our ways of communicating, etc. So that's where it comes from. I'm very interested in telling the stories that are not being brought to light. But that doesn't mean that they're not there. They're still latent, right? Well, so I think that the Missing Democracy poster, it's a kind of a play on that too, because it is a missing pet, so we don't even know where it's missing, right? It's missing, like the stories are missing too. But I think there's something playful, which I think is a very important component in my work, that if we call that pet democracy, then the story begins to become so much bigger, right? Because it is missing, it's something that we love, it's something also that we maybe don't fully understand, right? Because we don't fully understand our pets. Like we think we do, but I think they understand us better than we do to understand them. Personally, I can talk for my dog. But there's all these other elements that are very important. And that what happens if you create that metaphor of the democracy cat, right? I think we live in a sea of stories, and sometimes we don't get to see them, but that doesn't mean that we don't feel them, that they're not there, right? So that's where my work tries to bring those stories to light, but without revealing them too much, because I also think it's important to keep, because we were talking about the public space too, right? Like, when I'm talking about like revealing, or when I'm talking about like working with these stories, like what happens if I suddenly bring these stories to light? What happens when you bring these stories to the public space? I think that's interesting and important in certain for certain things, but I also worry because the public space being dominated by the dominant discourses, these stories can be appropriated. So it is also, I think, important to be careful and to leave that blurriness, because it's also it's a safety procedure sometimes to not tell the story, but just to let people know that there is a story. I think that's what I value the most.
In the ways that we're talking about public space as it exists now or as it was designed, what do you see as a possible future or even a possible new reality? What would you like public space to become? And the second part of that is, will we find the missing cat democracy in public space?
That's a very good question. Probably the missing cat democracy is hiding somewhere where they can get food. And that's okay. I think, like, I think for me, I chose the cat to be grumpy for that reason, because I think democracy is uncomfortable, and democracy can scratch you sometimes. And yeah, it's a grumpy place because it means that you have to be in discussion with a lot of people that sometimes you'd rather not be. So democracy for me is always going to be grumpy, right? Then we can decide if we don't want that grumpiness and we want eternal happiness. And that's then what I think neoliberalism strives to sell us, right? It doesn't achieve it, obviously, because it's not eternal happiness, but it strives to sell us eternal happiness. So I'm all for, not for unhappiness, but for grumpiness and discussions and, yeah, sometimes being upset and angry. So how can we find that in the public space, or whether we can find them in the public space? I think for that, the public space needs to be occupied by people. And I think sometimes it is achieved, like, I don't know, that happens to you in Philadelphia, but in Toronto, I love going to certain beaches where people just like bring all their stuff and they do their barbecues and their parties and they play whatever and they put music, you know. And yes, sometimes it bothers me because I'm in my quiet mood, but at the same time, I feel that interaction, and that is important to also like let the bodies have fun and let the bodies express themselves, or let the bodies like move around, you know, and not only this public space cannot only be about this very sometimes like intellectual consensus. The public space is going to involve bodies, and it's going to involve that we disagree. So I'm not sure the public spaces in our cities can hold that, because police will be called immediately, you know, and it will be called immediately against certain bodies more than others. So that's not democracy, you know, and that you know, that's not the values I want to see in democracy. Spaces that are abandoned in the middle of our cities, and for that I think that sometimes it requires to be a city that is not so extremely gentrified as Toronto, where there's no abandoned lots. But I think abandoned lots have a lot of potential, because there are lots that have been, when we say abandoned, it's abandoned by who, right? Abandoned by, like, the city hall, or abandoned by the owners, and then they may be reappropriated by the neighbors, right? And then those spaces, I think, things can happen that are much more democratic. And I'm sure they involve a lot of fights too, you know, but that's not bad.
In Toronto, is there a space or site or even monument that comes to mind as you're describing this, where maybe it wasn't scripted, maybe it was a little bit of a intervention, but that it achieves a level of grumpiness but also openness?
I really can't think of any right now. It's too sad. It's very sad. As I said, because I think Toronto is a very gentrified area, and there used to be a street just like right the corner from my house. But now they build a museum of contemporary art. So it's no longer that same space, right? So it's also interesting to see how art participates in this development so much. But I can't think of any. I can't think of any other, like, than, yeah, sometimes, you know, when I go to the beach. But that's a space that is, a site that is outside the city, in a way, you know, and it's still very policed. But there are ways that the beach space is like, has this fluctuation of freedom too, because the farther you go from the entrance, and you can feel the freedom, like, coming in and going out, you know. And but in Toronto, no, I'm really sorry, I cannot think of any place right now.
As we close our conversation, is there anything that comes to your mind that I didn't ask about, but maybe was raised in our conversation, that or thing worth putting out there?
Well, I really also think about this idea of public space and what does it mean to be public and for whom, you know, and I think like different populations may have different public spaces too. Like, I'm thinking in terms of like, I'm just gonna like rewind my thinking process. I was yesterday passing by this area that is being gentrified in Toronto, another area. And I saw this gigantic advertising for these new condos that are supposed to be about community living, right? But when you see, obviously, the people who are described in those condos, or who are like in the picture of the advertising, like, it's really strikingly like very white still, right? So I feel like it's also important to understand the, like, the race and gender dynamic involved in public space. And for me, as a white person, what does it mean for certain spaces to become public, when public means maybe opening it to a larger, whitest public? You know, and that makes me think, again, about the question of the secrecy, of the importance of having certain spaces that I don't know about, that they may be extremely public in Toronto, and it's good that I don't know about. Because the moment that someone as like me is going to know about, these spaces may be threatened.
Coco Guzman, thank you so much for joining the Monument Lab podcast. It was a lot of fun and of course, really important to be speaking with you again.
Thank you so much, Paul.
Next episode, we speak with Chicago's Eric Garcia about a historical figure worthy of more spotlight, Lucy Gonzalez Parsons, and his work as a critical cartoonist. You can listen to Monument Lab and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and anywhere you listen to podcasts. And if you like the show, remember to leave a rating or review. It really helps. The Monument Lab podcast is supported by the Cerdna Foundation. This podcast is written and produced by Paul Farber and Justin Geller. Designer and associate producer is William Roy Hodgson. Sound engineer, Justin Geller. Editorial coordinator, Steph Garcia. All music on the podcast is original by Mokita. I'm your host, Paul Farber. For more, visit us at monumentlab.com or find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook.